Let's brainstorm a bit. Assertion is a claim. It's the conclusion of your argument. So usually your assertion, you're just going to say something, and then in the rest of your argument, you'll explain why you think it's true, and you'll provide evidence for it. Like, you might give the assertion, the government could have stopped the genocide in Rwanda at minimal cost. And if you're making that assertion, that's the claim, then you're going to provide grounds. Grounds is analysis. It's logic. It's, you know, people say, why do you think this? And you give your answer. Why is it true that the government could have stopped the war in Rwanda? Or the genocide in Rwanda? Or I should say, the grounds for the assertion that the United States government could have stopped the genocide.
Because they had the resources
immediately. Absolutely. So we say, the genocide could have been stopped, assertion, because we had the resources. That's the ground. The final step is the warrant. And a warrant is proof. Evidence to prove your claim. So how do we prove that U.S. has the resources? U.S. has the strongest military in the world. So surely we can stop one genocide in one little country. We could destroy the entire planet. We could wipe out human civilization if we wanted to. So any military task that we want to perform, the U.S. military is probably up to the task. That's all we need to say. So assertion, we could have stopped the genocide. Grounds, we have the means. We have the military to make it happen. And then the warrant might be a piece of evidence giving the number for how much we spend on defense. So you say, we spend all this money on defense, surely we could have spared a little. You know, there's that evidence in the Red Book that says for $50 or $100 million, we could have stopped it. Some of the coaches were talking this morning at breakfast. They said, we could have just sent a few Apache helicopters over, and if we saw people running around with machetes down below, we stopped. It would have been expensive, but I don't think we would have even put anyone in danger on the American side. We had such a huge dominance. We're so dominant militarily. We just didn't get involved. And yeah, we saved a little bit of money along the way, but the question is it okay to save a little bit of money while people are slaughtering each other and we have a way to stop it? So this, by the way, is the most basic form of a kind of logic known as the Toulmin model. Toulmin was a logician. There are actually people called logicians. Like, that's what they do. They just sit around all day performing logic. Just doing logic. There are plenty of philosophers who are also engaging in logic. Most of philosophy is just testing ideas to see if they're viable or exposing logical flaws. The idea is any idea that isn't logical can be disregarded. But note that logic is just a machine. You feed facts in one side and you get facts out the other side. For instance, you have all cows eat grass, Betsy is a cow. You feed those two facts into one side of the machine. Logic just processes them and comes out with new facts. Betsy eats grass. You know, it takes different pieces of a syllogism and just creates a conclusion. But if you say, all cows eat beef, Betsy is a cow, therefore Betsy eats beef, that would be completely logically coherent. The problem isn't with the logic. The problem is you fed the wrong facts into the machine. So you need more than just solid logic. You need to feed the right facts in, and you need to prove that you have the right facts with the use of warrants and evidence. How many of you guys are switching over from policy debate? I have a few of you in the room, quite a few. So you guys are used to research and evidence. You're used to building big briefs full of opinions and statistics for every little detail. And in policy debate, a valid response for a lot of arguments is just to say, there's no evidence here. It's probably not the only response you want to run, but that's enough to really stop an argument dead in the water. In LD, we like to joke that, and it's true, I mean, you can win a round with no brief whatsoever for your own case. You just read what's written, and away you go. Because there's so much more of a focus on logic. But that really depends on the kind of case you're running and how your opponent is arguing against it. So let's talk about assertion types. The first kind of assertion you might make is a fact, some testable aspect of reality. So if I say the sky is blue, is that a fact? Barring weird weather, at least right now the sky is blue. But that's the thing though, if I'm colorblind and I say the sky is red, would I be correct? I'd see some other color, whatever that would be. But the reason we call it color blindness and not just alternate colors is if you see a different color from everyone else, you are mistaken. So, do we know what color the sky is? Who would decide that?
God would.
We have this idea called color, and we assign names to colors. So that color, we call it blue, or some variation in other languages. French is bleu. If I say that color is red, I'm referring to a different color other than that one. Whatever we're calling it, that specific color, which is a scientific product of certain light waves moving through the atmosphere, that is a color. We're all seeing it. And if I'm perceiving it incorrectly and I'm seeing the color red, my perception is incorrect and I'm wrong. So a colorblind person who says the sky is red is incorrect. But if I say, hey, everyone in this room, I know people call that color blue, but from now on, let's call it red. So that shirt is now red.
Does that make this blue?
Yes. And we all now carry blue books. That won't be confusing. Chris is going to be like, what just happened? So if we all agree on that, and then other people find out we're doing it, and it starts to catch on, and a year later we meet back and everyone is calling that color red. You might have some colorblind person who looks up and sees that color incorrectly and calls it blue because we decided to switch them. He would be wrong this time. He's like, come on, really? Everyone was saying it was blue. So that truth about what we call the color of the sky, what we call it, the name we assign to it, is decided by democracy. And that's the difference between objective and normative truth. Objective and normative. So an objective truth is something that we don't get to decide via democracy. Normative is something we do. So anything related to language, like what do the letters LOL mean?
Lol.
That's kind of true. I was a teenager back when that abbreviation was starting to become popular. You know, and we were using AOL Instant Messenger. America Online actually was a thing. And people say, well, what does it mean? It means laughing out loud or laughing online. But it doesn't really mean any of those things anymore. It's just lol. It just means this is funny. Sometimes it means all kinds of other things. People just put lol at the end of sentences. It's like, okay, lol. We just kind of have this understanding of what lol means because we use it all the time. In context, we've just learned this is what lol means. In contrast, can I put my hand through this podium? If I convince everyone that I can put my hand through this podium, can I do it? I still can't. You know, if I convince everyone that there's a chair here, and if I sit down, I won't just injure myself. Even if everyone believes it's true, we're all in for a surprise. That is an objective truth. Objectively, I can't push my hand through this metal podium. Objectively, there isn't a chair here. On the other hand, there's normative truths about things like the color of the sky. Or who the U.S. president is. You could consider that a normative truth. We all just get together and decide who it will be. Okay, there's another classification for different fact assertions. My favorite food is cheesy pasta, like macaroni and cheese, fettuccine Alfredo. Oh, I could just eat that stuff all day. Which of us has the correct favorite food?
I do.
Well, I think I have correct favorite food, mac and cheese. The thing is, you know, I became a vegetarian not for moral reasons or health reasons. It's because meat grosses me out. And I actually tried to get back into eating fish just for the sake of protein. I ate a California roll with fish in it, and I just couldn't stomach it. Now, you love sushi.
Yes.
But I was gagging on it. Now, I love vegetarian sushi. California rolls with just like rice and eggs.
Isn't
and
that this... not sushi? It's just a bunch of vegetables in a circle.
Fair enough. But it's prepared in a sushi style, you know, wrapped in seaweed and whatnot. But yeah, but other people would say it doesn't have raw seafood in it. It's not sushi. We all have different favorite foods. Bacon, ribs, mac and cheese, sushi. None of us are wrong, though. And what I might be gagging on, someone else really likes. There's no way for us to get together and decide this is the best food, this is the most enjoyable food. It's determined entirely by us. That's a subjective truth. A subjective truth is created solely by you. You decide it and it becomes true. Subjective truths, by the way, can be introduced into debate rounds in funny ways. Don't run the argument I'm about to give you. But one advanced debater, back when I competed, told the judge that he was going to create a disadvantage, a self-created disadvantage. He said, if you vote against me, the affirmative plan, this is a policy debate, the affirmative plan was about water conservation. And they said, we can save this many gallons per year. He said, if you vote against me, I'm going to just go into the public restroom and just start flushing toilets and running the water until more water has been wasted than you would have saved. That's pretty mean-spirited. But it's an example of a subjective truth. We are not saving water by voting affirmative because he decided it. He's just going to waste the water. The other kind, besides subjective, is descriptive. And those are definitions. Those are things that we can apply specifically to a fact. They're not subjective. We don't get to determine what they are. There could be an element of normativity within it, but something that's descriptive exists outside of us, like the nature of water. The other kinds of assertion besides fact, what else might you be able to feed into the logic machine?
Opinions.
Yes, spot on, an opinion. So in value debate, most of what we deal with is opinions. That's inherent in a resolution. We say privacy ought to be valued a certain way. There's no way to express that in terms of facts. It's not objective, normative, subjective, descriptive, nothing. It's just an opinion. We just feel like privacy should be valued at this level. We're assigning an arbitrary worth. There's two kinds of opinions, value and endorsement. An example of an endorsement is a plan advocate in policy debate, where somebody says, here's my proposed plan, and here's a piece of evidence from somebody that wants to do this exact plan. Now, it doesn't prove that this person is correct. You might both be mistaken. But it does sort of help to say, this isn't just my opinion, it's the opinion of some qualified expert as well. In value debate, you'll have endorsements from, you know, maybe a quotation from a president or a philosopher saying, you know, expressing your basic case idea, saying government's primary duty is to its own people. That would be an expression of an opinion. Yeah. Well, endorsements from a single person, I don't know if that would work, because normative is all about what the group of people decide. Unless it was somebody who is an expert on what everyone else thinks, or it was an individual person who decides what other people think. For instance, you could point to Justin Bieber as an example of teen fashion. And you could say, fashion is normative. But rather than just taking a poll on whether people prefer flare jeans or skinny jeans, let's just look at what Justin Bieber wears. Because other people will take their fashion from him. That sort of transitions us into the different kinds of evidence. Thomas Jefferson, let's call him a philosopher. That's not all he is, but for now, he was a philosopher. He thought he had ideas about things. What can a philosopher prove? When would it be appropriate? What kind of assertions would it be appropriate to read a philosopher for? Let me ask you this. Is Thomas Jefferson more qualified than you are? Why? If you studied an objective truth for a really long time and were well respected in that area, that might be a good reason to listen. But when we're discussing values, they're inherently arbitrary. The only way that we can make a decision on that is things like conscience and emotion. And all Thomas Jefferson had to work with was the gray matter between his ears. And you have that too, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's such a relief. So you and Thomas Jefferson are equally equipped to make value assertions. The same goes for Aristotle and Kant and Nietzsche, any other philosopher you want to break out. Yeah. So philosophers are not more credible than you, which means you could sort of use them to back up a value or to some degree, maybe an endorsement. So Thomas Jefferson has experience in the field of the purpose of government. What if I quote some 80-year-old guy talking from his trailer. We've never heard of him. He's my grandpa's friend. And he says government needs to only protect its own citizens. Is that a good example? This is a guy who's just been sitting around for 80 years. He's very opinionated. Anyone who comes within earshot, he'll just barrage them with his opinions about the purpose of government and how the government's messing up right now. So he has 80 years of experience dealing with this issue. And at his age, it's safe to assume he's really wise.
Well, maybe it's not necessarily wisdom and experience that issue, but maybe just experience and having an opinion on that issue.
Experience and have... Well, once again, though, this guy's very opinionated. He knows how to have opinions on things.
Yeah.
Also, in debate rounds, you probably want to have sources that are pretty well-known.
You want to quote sources that are well-known. But when it comes to philosophers, the fact that he's well-known, all that really does is enhance your credibility. It doesn't prove anything. Because, and here's where we sort of get back into the epistemology thing, it isn't really possible to prove a value or endorsement. You can prove what people think about the issue. You could prove that Thomas Jefferson felt this way. But if Thomas Jefferson wasn't making an assertion about something subjective, like if Thomas Jefferson wasn't saying, my favorite food is hamburgers, then you can't prove it. Or if you have some pollster saying, I don't know what a pollster saying, Obama is probably going to win the next election. He's qualified to make that assertion, even though he's probably talking about mostly people's different values. But if he's saying Obama would be the best president, no matter how qualified he is, he can't prove that because what best is so subjective. It's so much an aspect of opinion that you can't prove it at all. So what a philosopher does, he provides eloquence. He sort of shows the judge, this isn't just my harebrained idea off the wall. I did research this topic, and there are other people like Thomas Jefferson who agree with me. And therefore, you can take my ideas more seriously. But the fact that Thomas Jefferson or Aristotle said it doesn't inherently make your idea any better. And that means... everyone in this room, we're all philosophers. And you are more than welcome to add to the conversation. You're right that you're not as wise or as experienced as Thomas Jefferson, and the odds that you have something worthwhile to contribute are very low.
Thanks.
But you should at least be engaging in philosophy. Maybe you'll be reinventing the wheel, but you're doing it. And, be listening to other philosophers. Come up with your own ideas. See what happens. You're just as qualified as any other philosopher because the only credential you need is to have a conscience and the ability to perform logic. That's it. What's another piece of evidence you might present in a round besides a philosopher? Yeah.
But is that he proves the value or just that he validates it?
Validates is what I would say. It makes it easier for the judge to accept. So it's almost entirely on the level of persuasion and credibility. Logically, if you feed Thomas Jefferson's support of your idea into the logic machine, it'll just throw it right out. It doesn't have anything to work with. Anything else besides philosophers you might quote? Policy debaters, you quote other things besides philosophers all the time. Yeah.
People who are
accredited. So, experts. What can an expert prove? We'll get to statistics in a second here. Although an expert could provide statistics, but I would consider those to be its own kind of evidence. So yes, almost any kind of fact an expert can back you up on, as long as he knows that field. He can say Obama's the most popular. He can say that specific color is light sky blue. There are people who professionally just name colors. Can you imagine? Like they just like naming paints and things.
Just imagine the wild times they have.
They'll have dictionaries, just swatches of color that look almost exactly the same. Like you'll have like page after page of dark cyan type colors. And this is ocean mist. Yes. The head taster for Dreyer's ice cream died a few years ago. And he was found to have, see if I can remember this, exactly what he had. It was like 33% milk sugar in his blood. Like there was just so much cream in him. I can't even imagine, because all he did was sit around all day professionally eating ice cream. I forget exactly what it was, but it was some component of ice cream. 33% of his blood was that.
Wow.
Crazy. There are folks who professionally just sit in a dark room with only red light, because that enhances your sensations, and people will throw food at them through a hole, and they'll eat it and comment. Sometimes all they have to do is guarantee that it's the correct taste. They're just assuring consistency at the factory. Look, it's like being in prison. Your little slot opens, and the food comes out, the thing drops back down, you eat it, and it's just like, yep, this batch is good. You push the button, and it gets shipped. Those are experts in taste. That could be a fun job, maybe. But, you know, after the millionth cheese ball, you're like, but after the millionth cheese ball, you're going to be really good at noticing if there's any difference. Okay, another thing that an expert can do is provide an endorsement, which, once again, it's an opinion. And that means it can't be proven, but an expert would be appropriate for providing an endorsement. Like, we were talking about the Rwanda example. There's a piece of evidence that says we could have stopped the genocide if we spent $50 to $100 million on it. That's an expert providing an endorsement to the idea of intervening in the Rwanda genocide. Now, he can't prove that absolutely. Maybe there would have been some problem. We're shipping the people over, and there's a storm, and the ship sinks, and it ends up costing way more. We don't know for sure how much it would have cost. Maybe things would have escalated, and World War III would have started. But he's somebody who's qualified enough that it seems like a reasonable statistic. We can believe it would have cost in that range. Okay, the other thing that you mentioned is statistics. What can a stat prove? A fact? So could a statistic prove... Okay, I could prove a quantity. Like, you could prove that the majority of the Earth's surface is water using a statistic. That is a statistic. Or you could prove that the majority of Americans support Barack Obama. Yes. Opinions? Yes, like polls would be great. So I would say some facts and opinions. There are other things statistics can't really do. It'd be very hard, for instance, to prove that my favorite food is cheesy pasta based on statistics. You might try to measure how much I eat cheesy pasta, but I really try to control that because, you know, I don't need it. So I'll splurge as much as I can, but you can't really say he eats it a lot, therefore he likes it. That would be like, I don't know, protein powder and breakfast cereal. I don't like it as much, but I eat a lot of it. So there's a lot of other things you can't prove using statistics, but polls and empirical data. This many people died from dandelion poisoning last year. And by the way, that number's in the thousands. What's another thing besides stats that you might bring up in a round?
History.
Okay. What could history prove? An implied endorsement. But could history provide value? No. History is just raw facts, mostly. So it provides an endorsement because it shows how things work. We could say fighting a war on two fronts doesn't work. We know that historically because there are examples of people fighting wars on two fronts, and they lose. So that's one thing that they could do. They could also, of course, provide objective facts about history. Ray Charles is no longer alive. That's an objective fact. That's part of history. Another source that's commonly invoked in LD is common knowledge. Is that a viable source? So what would it prove? Opinions. Okay, good. You're absolutely right. It can back up both kinds of opinions. For instance, we all know that we shouldn't watch a bully beat up a kid and not step in. I'm not quoting some philosopher about it, but we just know that it should be that way. It's almost like an appeal to conscience, but it's common knowledge. Yeah.
And it could also be like a known fact. Like, it's common knowledge at the time.
Yes. So, for instance, if somebody says, Hitler didn't commit suicide, prove it. And you're like, I don't really have evidence for that, but it's common knowledge. We just all know it. Anything that you would expect everyone in the room to know, you can just appeal to common knowledge. However, the moment your opponent disagrees with common knowledge, things start to get kind of dicey. How about yourself? Can you ever quote yourself as evidence?
I don't think I trust that.
Well, yeah, because self is so heavily biased. And it's sort of implied everything you say that isn't quoted is you. So, of course, you're saying it, albeit somewhat insincerely, because you're a debater, you've been assigned a position. And that's where things start to change, is if you have some sort of special credential just besides the fact that you have an opinion on it. I give you an example. My older brother, in a national round, he was arguing that we should legalize a certain pesticide known as methyl bromide. And there were claims he made about the safety of methyl bromide that were blatantly untrue. Maybe not blatantly, that's not the right adjective. But they were completely untrue. The judge, of course, how many people here have heard of methyl bromide? One. So most folks have never heard of it. The judge is like, I don't know what's up with methyl bromide. These guys didn't have any evidence, but it was banned for a reason, presumably. So my brother Ryan reached into his wallet and showed a card to the judge and said, I am a certified California pesticide applicator. And I'm telling you right now, these are the safety details on methyl bromide. He's presenting himself as the expert. And yeah, he's biased, but you can be the expert if you know something about the topic. You know, I have been to the top of Pikes Peak, and I can tell you, there is no Buddhist shrine up there.
How did your brother do in that debate?
Oh, he won.
I thought you could show the judge stuff, though.
Well, back then there was a rule about the size of visual aids. I'm not sure what it is now, but at the time you could show something that was on an 8.5 by 11 paper or smaller. So he could show a card, or I had one guy who would show pictures. You know, people would say, we need to ally ourselves with such and such a country. This is when we're supposed to change our trade policy toward Middle East or Africa. And so he'd show pictures. We'd say, we should ally ourselves with Saudi Arabia. And he'd show pictures on 8.5 by 11 papers of people burning American flags in Saudi Arabia. They hate us. I don't think that's still legal. Always double check the rules. The rules are out to get you, so... Double check, when in doubt, check the tournament coordinator. Okay, a few other sources. We don't necessarily need to write these down, but a couple quick comments. You could produce a news clipping that could be presented as assertions of many different kinds of facts. A journalist is really not a reliable source of opinion. You know, just saying, we need to lower taxes. There's your endorsement. But if it's just some journalist saying it, all he does is write opinions. You know, there's... It's going to add just a tiny, tiny bit of credibility to your own words, but almost nothing. You know, some blogger said this. But news clippings can be effective. I remember at a debate camp where our opportunity for research was fairly limited, I was running a case. This is, once again, in policy experience. But I was running a case proposing the Ronald Reagan Memorial Highway, which would run from New York to L.A. It was a vacuum tube that you could sit in a train and accelerate with no friction, so you could get from one side of America to the other in 45 minutes. The only downside to this is that it costs about $1 million per mile. But the technology does exist. So we said it would just change everything and totally be worth it, and we'd just, in advertising, we wouldn't have to charge people tickets. Advertising would be enough to pay it off. Our case was really struggling, and as I was walking out of the hotel the day of the tournament, the last day, there's a front page article in USA Today talking about how South Korea just installed its own EFT system, or I think it was China. And of course, it's not as long as the one we proposed, but they had installed it and it was working. So people would say, well, there's all these safety issues with EFT transportation and whatnot. And so I would pull out the actual paper, according to USA Today, today, and, you know, read a few highlighted portions. And now that was kind of fun for assertions of fact. It's just kind of dispel a lot of these ideas about practicality. You can also reference a pop figure. I saw an LDer who would begin and end all of her speeches with quotations from a Black Eyed Peas song. A pop figure can pretty much be equated... it didn't go over well with me, I'll say that. Not that I hate everything Black Eyed Peas did, but I was like, why are you quoting them? Just stop. Where's the love? I don't know. But you could consider a pop figure to be a philosopher. That's at least how artists view themselves. Some of them are pretty hard to take seriously, but they think of themselves as having all these deep thoughts to share with you. So once again, the primary purpose of quoting a song or an author, maybe reading some quotation from a great piece of literature, would be for the sake of eloquence. In addition, you can quote a source, which is really powerful for proving itself. For instance, you say the Fourth Amendment prohibits it. How are you going to prove that? By reading the Fourth Amendment. So, as a side note, by the way, having the entire text of the Constitution on hand is kind of a must. The Cato Institute puts out these tiny little pocket Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and amendments. They're really small. You can fit it in a pocket. There's really no excuse not to have it. Right on. There it is, right there. Get that. Have it somewhere in your bag. You never know when you'll need it.
Yeah, and the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence.
There you have it.
Do you need like a magnifying glass?
No, you can see it.
It's a little small, but it's readable. So have it on hand. That's an important source document. In these years' resolutions, I don't know that there's anything that you guys are always going to need in terms of a source. Some of you might need to at least read the Patriot Act, but printing it out might be a stretch. Some of you do need to, but most of you don't. Just be familiar with it. But knowing the Constitution is always important. It's proof of itself. The last element, the last kind of evidence you might read, a reference. For instance, when Ryan broke out that certified pesticide applicator card, he was invoking his knowledge, the fact that he had memorized this really thick book called, I think it was the Pesticide Data Manual or something, this heavy green book full of text much smaller than that. It was ridiculous how well he knew it. Like, we would just open up to a random page and say, Gramoxone, what's the required safety gear for application? And he would just know. So you can read a reference. You can break out a manual for the operation of a motorcycle. You might break out a dictionary. References are never going to prove opinions, but they are going to prove certain kinds of facts. For instance, a dictionary is going to prove normative facts related to language. And there are some languages, like Spanish, that are decided by a group of people. There's a committee that decides the future of the Spanish language, and they'll just announce, we have decided this. That's why Spanish makes so much sense now, while English is just a shambles. It's a disaster. Because everyone just kind of makes things up. In 1066, a French duke invaded England and forced everyone to speak French. So everyone just kind of mixed the old pre-French English with French. And then we just keep mixing and matching everything. Americans, of course, are stealing things all over the place. So English doesn't make a lick of sense. But nonetheless, a dictionary from somewhere like Merriam-Webster's, that'd be considered a credible reference. And you'll definitely have definitions debates where you say, my dictionary is more credible than your dictionary, and determining a normative fact. Because either you have a better pulse on the actual meaning, or you get to decide this dictionary is so well established that it decides what the meaning is. Like you might say that of Merriam-Webster's. It's such a well-established dictionary, people will correct their opinions of the word. Well, Merriam-Webster's is, the online dictionary at least, is updated regularly. And they're constantly adding words like woot was recently added. Nobody says that anymore, but it was added. The word woot.
I found out how they put words in the dictionary, though. A committee does not decide it. They actually find it in pop culture, and if it's used over a period of time, they put it in the dictionary.
Right. So their standard, Merriam-Webster's standard for putting things in the dictionary is, if it satisfies a certain standard of normativity, it qualifies as part of the language. We won't judge them. We'll just put it in. LOL is in the dictionary. In Spanish, though, it doesn't work that way. And a quick note, by the way, don't cite a source as dictionary.com. Dictionary.com just collates other dictionaries. Most of the time, Dictionary.com is actually the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language, 4th edition, 2000. Which is a lot more credible. So look down at the bottom. It'll be in little print. Sometimes it's WordNet from Princeton University. Oh, great source, by the way, for definitions. My one-stop shop is onelook.com. You put a word in there, and you're going to get a list of all the different dictionaries that define that term, divided in groups. So you have general dictionaries, business dictionaries, law dictionaries, onelaw.com. It's great. Credibility does matter. Now, you're trying to find a definition that's going to work with your case logic. For instance, are you NCSCA or?
Yes.
Okay. I was going to use an example from Stoa. I'm going to do it anyway. So we have two broad kinds of definitions of privacy. One that says you're secluded, and the other kind that says you get to choose whether you're secluded or not. So people might say you're posting a bunch of information on Facebook, but it's their choice to do it, so they didn't actually violate privacy. But using that first definition, you're secluded, you're saying you're violating your own privacy by doing this. So you're going to go out. You're not going to say, I'm just going to find the most credible dictionary. You're going to say, my case needs to have this kind of definition of privacy. Okay. And within that, you'll go with the one You know, you might find three or four definitions. You'll choose the one that's most credible of that group, the one that's going to be easiest to defend. You will, however, find, say, two philosophers that disagree, like Thomas Jefferson disagreeing with Immanuel Kant, or Hobbes and Locke disagreeing on the finer points of social contract. You know, Rousseau disagreeing with Jesus, frankly. So, in that case, you know, if you have a disagreement between Thomas Jefferson and Immanuel Kant, again, this is both just the product of them using their best version of logic to create value assessments. You're just as qualified to do that. So it's not like Immanuel Kant is more qualified than the other guy. Don't get into that debate, because there isn't an objective way to determine the credentials of opinions. Just say, here's my qualified source, and then talk about why he's right. That's what's important. And that's what I want to leave you guys with as a takeaway. Evidence can be really important. And if you're trying to assert some sort of fact, having the evidence to back yourself up is key. However, it's not nearly as important as it is in policy debate, and in most cases, it's kind of optional. With my privacy case, Trust the Cops, the negative case for STOA, I need certain statistics to prove my case. The Italian police authorized this many wiretaps. In the United States, they don't authorize that many wiretaps. Here are the crime rates in these two areas. But then I take those four sets of facts, feed them into my logic machine, and come out with the conclusion that if the U.S. used more wiretaps, there would be less violent crimes. You could certainly attack my logic, but you can't attack my facts. Well done, guys. So, 10-minute break, and then we'll meet back, and I think Matt has some cool stuff to say.